Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today I'll be interviewing Justin Foster. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. Justin, where did your love for language come from? Where did it originate?
You know, Maurice, it could be one of those things that you're born with, you know, the classic nature nurture. But I think there were some conditions that created it. I grew up in a Christian fundamentalist cult, essentially. Not a very well-run cult, but very cult-like in its behavior. And part of that was that none of the members had TVs and didn't go to movies. Some of us, my parents were slightly rebellious, had a stereo with LPs, you know, with vinyl. So I fed my imagination by reading. And I learned early on the value of communicating with the written language. And so that combination of, I had no other way to express or experience curiosity, and my voracious appetite for knowledge, that was the roots of it. Early on, as far back as I can remember, 3 or 4 years old, when I was probably 5 or 6, I just started a thing. If I didn't know what a word was, I would ask what it meant, or I would look it up in a dictionary. And I still at 53 do that when I look it up online and go, oh, I didn't know that word existed.
And did that also foster your imagination? Did that help your imagination to kind of escape from that cult-like environment?
Yeah, definitely was a form of escapism. And it wasn't, it's interesting for me, it wasn't like going and reading like Lord of the Rings or, you know, some sort of like fantasy. I read a lot of nonfiction as a kid, and also read a lot of, I loved the Western theme. And so what that meant to me though, was really about justice. And that's been a prevailing theme in my life ever since I was a little kid, of this awareness of injustice. And I was aware of the injustice of the very restrictive and spiritually abusive traits of the religious sect, but also the violence at home and the inconsistencies in my parents. And so reading, and then later writing, was less about escaping to a different reality or like a fantasy, and much more about creating a new reality. I remember my whole childhood is I just wanted to get out of there. And I did. I moved out when I was 17.
And there was some abuse going on within your home, right?
Correct. Yes. I've since reconciled with my mother, and we have a decent relationship. She was ill-equipped to handle parenting someone like me as a first child. You know, I didn't find out till many, many years later about neurodiversity and, you know, having ADHD. I'm an 8 in the Enneagram, which means I like to fight. And so she was not really equipped for that as someone that had her own deeply unintegrated trauma. And there's power in forgiveness. And in many ways, I think of Mary Oliver, one of my favorite poets, who said many years ago, I was given a box of darkness, but I didn't realize until recently it was a gift. And so I look at all of those components of my childhood, of these strange, like growing up on a ranch, growing up in the 70s and 80s, growing up in a religious cult, growing up in a violent, emotionally and physically abusive home. All of that really was A gift. I wouldn't want to repeat it. And I made sure my sons never experienced anything even remotely close to that. But I also don't resent it anymore.
And you said you were able to forgive your mom, is your dad as well?
Yeah, my dad is an interesting thing. He was never, I mean, he could be violent sometimes, but he was more, I don't know if you watched The Office, but he was a lot like Michael Scott. He was sort of a pleasant sociopath. Like he didn't form normal emotions. And I just remember, even as a little kid, I had no expectations of him, of like he was going to be anything different than he was. And so with that, I have forgiven myself for what I thought I had to do to become a man not like him. And, you know, that hardened me in many ways. And it made me live a split life. It made me do things that were out of alignment with what I would call my values, because I was trying to become something different than him. So mostly related to that father dynamic or that father wound is I forgave myself.
What do you mean by your belief, love never looks away?
Well, I think that love is the fundamental energy that, you know, everything is built on. You know, I think that at some point I would not be surprised if they find out that love is an energy that is innate in everything. And we don't have the science to prove that yet. And I look at like the great spiritual teachers, you know, Jesus, Buddha, many others, more modern ones like Thomas Merton or Eckhart Tolle, is if you're not loving, if you think you love someone, but you look away from their pain, you look away from their circumstances. And this is why as a, what I call a SWAM, a straight white American male, that if I truly love humanity, I cannot look away from systemic injustice. It's offensive to the people that are experiencing it. And it's offensive to my own soul, because it's not love. Not love in the purest divine cosmic sense. And so this goes into this idea that love is showing up for people. Love is being honest with yourself and people. Love is, and then ultimately, no matter what, how ugly something is or painful something is, or something you don't want to look at or deal with, is that you let love point you to it. Because if you do that, you will figure out what to do. You will get through it. And so that's why I live that, try to live that mantra daily. I fail frequently, but I believe it deeply.
That's fascinating. Why do you believe, well, some reasons you believe we look away as a society?
Well, I think it's a matter of, some of it's just human nature. It's like Eli Weisel, the person that was really kind of famous after World War II as a Nazi hunter, said, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's apathy. And we are sort of built, we've built a system in our country. And I love our country, and I think we are the most amazing, diverse, one of the most amazing, diverse countries on earth. You know, I'm very much a patriot, but I'm also a realist in that if the system is working for you, apathy is a normal reaction, a normal indicator of a lack of consciousness. That's normal. And so if in order for someone, and this is why, someone has an elevated level of consciousness when something unexpected happens. They have a child that comes out as LGBTQT, or they have they fall in love with a person of that's of a different ethnicity, or their child falls in love with someone of a different background, and the reality of those things then is right there, and you have to pay attention to it unless you're dead inside. But I think apathy is the baseline, and it takes courage to go beyond that. And That's why I think many people resort to cliches, like, you know, I'm not a racist, or all lives matter, or, you know, that kind of thing, because to admit that you might be wrong is going to require you to no longer be apathetic.
And it call it, it many times it may call for change.
Yeah, especially change of a system that you're directly benefiting from. And, you know, most people won't do that.
True. And you inspire people to go inward, embrace the mystery of who they are. Mm-hmm. How has that developed within your life, the process of learning to embrace the mystery within you?
Yeah, I think that by our nature as humans, we develop kind of a hologram, you know, kind of an adult hologram to kind of make it in the world. We would call that maybe an identity. If you're a trauma survivor, that identity really's main job is to keep you safe. And so in safety to the ego, safety to the hologram is predictability. It is certainty. It's systems and structures. And so when you, part of going inward is understanding that the hologram is not who you are. Like, you are not your thoughts and feelings. You have thoughts and feelings, but they're not you. And there's a very simple exercise where you can just sit and watch your thoughts. And I always ask the person who's like, can you see your thoughts? You know, yeah. Okay. Who's the observer? Well, the observer is who you really are. So now we have to go into this idea of sometimes what I call mud-covered Buddhas. So, you know, there was that, these Buddha, huge Buddhist gold statues of Buddha that were covered in mud to protect them from being ransacked by invaders. And I think we humans are like that in many ways. We're mud-covered. And the other thing that we recognize is something Nishi said about, you know, if you stare too long into the abyss, you become the abyss, is life is so wildly unpredictable, beyond comprehension, unpredictable. So we make it predictable, especially in, you know, industrialized countries. We make it predictable because the alternative is terrifying. Well, if that's true on a macro level or at a societal level, it's true on a personal level too. And the brain does not like to change. So it's what I call sometimes the art of unfinishing, is that there's so much of life that is unpredictable that this sort of obsession with emptying your inbox and finishing your to-do list and, you know, executing the plan and all that. And those are important. Those are important things sometimes. But doing inner work means that you're not going to be able to use those skills to get to know your own soul. There is no to-do list. There is no operating system per se. There is no calendar. There's just the work of spiritual and emotional nudity of seeing who you really are. And so that's what that means. It's a mystery. Most of us don't know who we are. I'm still figuring it out, because it also evolves. We're evolutionary creatures. So we're evolving constantly, maybe building new holograms and letting them die. I've once said that I've attended 1,000 funerals of who I used to be.
Yeah. The art, you said the art of unfinishing.
Yes.
When you said that, I thought of when I was a child, probably no more than about 10, 11 years old, me and my cousin, we grew up together, and it was summertime, so we were at home, and my great aunt and her husband, they told us that pest control was coming by to spray the kitchen and other areas, but primarily the kitchen for, you know, roaches and whatever rodents. And pest control came and they sprayed the cabinets. And when they were done, I noticed a white milky substance that was on the floor. And I said to myself, I said, I don't want that to be there when my great aunt and her husband return home. So I took a mop and I just cleaned up all of that stuff so it would be nice when they came home. And when they came home, they was like, did pest control come? And I said, yeah, they came. And she said, I don't see anything. And I said, oh, the stuff that was on the floor, I cleaned all of that up. But it was done. I thought it was undone, but it was finished in that unfinished seeming state. And like you're saying, we try to complete things and finish things and put a little bow on things, but right. It's possible to be okay in that state that it's in, although it seems unfinished.
Yeah. And we have, Maurice, we have these, you know, we have these industrial-based systems, these machine-based systems that rely heavily on, you know, pushing something out the other end of the assembly line, whether it's a car or it's code or it's, you know, content. And again, there's no problem there, but it's not reality. You look at nature. You take one cubic inch of nature, it changes every day. And nature is cyclical. Nature is not bound by what they call chronos time or human time. It does not know about seconds or minutes or even years. It knows something called chronos time, which is this sort of rhythm. And life is like jazz that way, or the blues, or in that kind of, you are improvising as you go, but you have to get the basic principles figured out.
Yeah. Can you share a success story of helping someone discover that inward journey within them?
Yeah, I can. I have many. I've been doing this for a while in this current iteration, just the past year, because we're blending it with social justice, not just finding yourself to be happier, but finding yourself in order to go create an impact in the world. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you a recent example. We have a client, a friend, a Mark, who had this calling for 12 years to essentially become a voice for awareness of religious abuse, especially for LGBTQ people. Mark is gay and still identifies as a Christian, but so to him, it wasn't enough to be inclusive, you know, to go to like an Episcopalian church or something that's inclusive. Is that his calling was to show that his sexuality and sexual identity was actually a gift. And it was an extension of a person's faith, not in spite of a person's faith. And that he believes that religious abuse is the result of flawed theology. So this is a big thing. This is not a person who has a divinity degree or anything. He works for a big company and is a senior leader. He's 55, lives in New York with his husband. You know, this is not someone that is, you know, out of casting central for becoming a queer mystic. And in working with Mark, he'd already knew his calling. He already knew who he was. But the great success is now he knows what to do with it. And I think it's a two-parter. And I can give you lots of stories about helping people kind of find out who they are. Mm-hmm. But the greater success is taking who you really are, taking that true story, and then going out and creating some sort of contribution to the advancement of humanity through a variety of ways. And I do absolutely believe that everyone has a calling, but it doesn't end with that. It doesn't end with knowing who you are and what you're here to do. It ends in actually going and being that in the world. So that's why I love telling his story as a success story.
Thank you for sharing that. How would you define a calling?
That's a great question. You know, callings are often, they kind of seem to come in a couple of ways. One is like this long time whisper that just won't go away. And some people experience that way. Some people experience a calling as like in the Bible, Saul, who became Paul, had this, you know, revelation on the road to Damascus. Some people experience it that way. That's what happened to me. Like this moment where I just woke up. And those waking up moments can often happen through tragedy. Somebody loses a loved one, you know, or they overcome or survive, you know, a major illness or something. And there's something about that being cracked open that reveals that calling. And a calling has three indicators. One is it feels like it's coming from within sight of you. It's hard to explain that deeper, but it's just like a whisper, a small voice. The second is that it will require you to change the systems around you. It may require you to move. It may require you to switch careers, but it doesn't, you don't get to live your calling using the same exact systems that got you here. And the third is that we'll make a dent in the universe, and it's going to require an enormous amount of courage. Because the first thing that happens, and this is what my partner Virginia works on with our clients, the first thing that happens when you start to live your life according to your calling is your mind will try to stop you because of all its own internalized propaganda about what you need to be and your identity and all of that stuff. So I often will say this sort of half jokingly is, you know what you're calling when it's terrifying and you're like, and it's anxiety. It's not like this happy thing. It's like a, oh man, I got to do this. I don't want to do this. I have a good life living in the suburbs, but it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away. If it does go away, that's not ever a good sign.
Yeah. It's it costs something.
It costs something. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And could you share you had a moment? Could you share that?
Yeah, absolutely. Had begun to question a lot of things about what I believed in back in the mid 2000s. And in 2011, I had a mental breakdown. And coming out of that mental breakdown, I really, really began to question things. And allowing myself to doubt. Doubt is such a gift. And allowing myself to doubt and question. And then one day in April of 2014, I was working out in the gym and thinking about all these questions I had, thinking about what the future might look like and lifting weights. And I sat up and I looked in the mirror and I saw a lion head on like my face. My head was a lion's head. And I describe it as I met me. I met my true self. And that the hologram that I had created to survive the childhood trauma and all the other stuff, that's when he began to die in that moment. And it was terrifying to my wife at the time. My kids are like, what happened to you? And friends. And I was like, I met myself. And it was from there that a calling started to emerge that was really a pattern about justice, that spirituality, true spirituality, has a social justice component, whether we want it to or not.
And your loved ones could actually see the change within you.
Yes, definitely.
What is your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, that's such a profound question. I think it's to understand what you really want. I think there's a fundamental, like two things we need to know to move forward into life with any sort of intentionality. And that's, we have to know who we are. Much of our discussion is about that. But we also have to know what we want, and we have to have the courage to write it down. And so when you write it down, I don't know how manifest, I don't necessarily believe in manifesting or the law of attraction or any of that stuff. I don't know how that works. I'm too much of a scientist to say it's all just, you know, magic. But I will say when you write it down, it, and you do that inner work and you write it, and then you write it down and then you share it with the people around you as a kind of a manifesto of what you want, something happens. Something shifts, some sort of vibration goes out into the ethos. And by the very act of writing it down, you begin to make it real for your mind. And I would encourage people as kind of a subset to this, is it's okay to want to be a millionaire. It's okay to want to have the perfect partner, whatever. That's great. But the deeper question is, how would having those things contribute to your calling, to contribute to advancing humanity?
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.